I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. This week, Governor Hogan revealed a plan for spending $700 million to eliminate blight across Baltimore. 4,000 properties have been identified as vacant and will be demolished, beginning with a block in the Sandtown-Winchester neighborhood. We get reaction to the governor's controversial plan from urban designer Klaus Philipson and activist Lucky Crosby. Then the Baltimore Sun's John Fritzy brings us up to speed on the race to fill the U.S. Senate seat now held by Barbara Mikulski. Who's ahead? And has Congressman Elijah Cummings missed his chance to contend? Plus, Under Armour CEO Kevin Plank's real estate venture unveiled an ambitious design to redevelop Port Covington in South Baltimore. We get details from Baltimore Business Journal reporter Melody Simmons. All on Midday after the news. Welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks so much for tuning in. Today in our Friday News Roundup, we'll touch base with former Midday producer and now Baltimore Business Journal real estate reporter Melody Simmons about Under Armour CEO Kevin Plank's development vision for Port Covington. We'll also hear from Julie Bort, tech editor of Business Insider, on some health box, the new wearable fitness tracking technology from Under Armour. Plus, the Baltimore Sun's John Fritzy will join us to catch us up on the race to fill the Senate seat of Barbara Mikulski. But up front, Governor Hogan stood with Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake and a big bulldozer on Tuesday to unveil his plan for $700 million to be spent to eliminate blight in Baltimore.
You should all know by now that I'm a guy on a mission who wants to get things done and wants to get them done now. So our work will begin not years from now, but right now, today, this afternoon, with the 1,000 block of North Stricker Street you see behind us.
The effort is known as Project CORE, for Creating Opportunities for Renewal and Enterprise. It has identified 4,000 properties across the city to be demolished over the next 4 years. By far the biggest share of the money, more than $600 million, will be subsidies for developers to build retail space and affordable housing units. The announcement has been both applauded and lamented, and here to give us some reaction to the announcement is architect and urban designer Klaus Philipson of Arc Plan Incorporated, author of the Community Architect blog. Klaus, welcome back to Midday.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us by phone is lifelong Sandtown resident and community organizer Lucky Crosby Sr. Welcome to the show, Lucky.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm glad you could join us. Tell me what your concerns are. You've expressed some concerns, Mr. Crosby, about the governor's plan. What are they?
Yeah, first of all, I must say, when you had 50% unemployment in a neighborhood like Sandtown, Winchester, maybe some of the community residents could have been involved in a demolition project. That's case in point. When you have close to 6 out of every 10 kids being poisoned by lead paint, I didn't see any lead paint reduction or hazard reduction done. All I seen was a hose being sprayed on the dust once the bulldozers crashed into the building. Two, when you got a 75,000 plus public housing waiting list, don't you think some of them houses could have been rehabbed that put some of those families in on the waiting list? Four, what community input was given to this project? Now, again, I'm not against the governor. I believe the governor is proactive and the government is doing something when our mayor and our housing commissioner have continued to do nothing.
Okay, you just put a whole lot of thoughts on the table, Mr. Crosby. Let me ask Klaus Philipson what your reaction is, both to the governor's plan and to some of the concerns that Lucky Crosby raised.
Yeah, I would think that what Lucky said is all right. I would subscribe to that as well. Same concerns. In addition, I have urban design architecture concerns. All of West Baltimore over there is designated historic district under the National Register District because the houses were originally architecturally valuable houses. There are beautiful churches, beautiful squares, and knocking out a block in the middle of it is just not a strategy. So what I'm thinking is that in the short term, there are probably residents, there are certainly residents, I spoke with some, who say that this is much better to have a vacant lot or a vacant block there than dilapidated houses. But in the long term, What is the strategy? What is the long-term vision of this? And then, as Lucky says, the deconstruction of those houses could be done with local forces. Everything that is done should be done with local input.
I want to pick up on a point that Lucky Crosby made, and you sort of alluded to it too just now. You talked about a vacant lot, a vacant block. I get the impression that Governor Hogan's plan is very much to clear whole blocks, to tear down whole blocks of vacant homes. And I think, Lucky Crosby, you were saying there are probably some homes that could be salvaged.
Correct. I grew up and I played in that block as a child. There are some beautiful structures that were three-story structures that in my time of playing as a child, they were three-story apartments. Then it was rehabbed by the Housing Authority of Baltimore City. Then it was bricked up. All the ones that you see with the front and back doors and windows center blocked up, they were owned by the Baltimore City Housing Authority, and they chose not to do anything with them but just to let them sit.
Well, I take your point, but what I'm trying to understand is in terms of the question you pointed to, Klaus, about what will come after the demolition. It's my impression that it's a lot easier to come up with a redevelopment for a full vacant block than to redevelop around homes that have been preserved.
That is true, but demolition of a whole block does not create a market. So that is a misunderstanding. It is easier, but you still won't have anybody doing it. There are plenty of vacant blocks in West Baltimore and in East Baltimore where you can see the problem. And we can have only so many community gardens and so many parks. So in the long run, when I look down 20, 30 years down the road, I can easily see Sandton would be a revitalized community that would come back to the glory that it once had, and that between the West Baltimore MARC station and downtown, that whole area with Sandtown, Harlem Park, and so on, could be revitalized utilizing the beautiful architecture of the buildings. And when you squint your eyes and you're looking north from that 1,000 North Stricker block, one block north, it has street trees, it has these three-story buildings that Lucky described, you know, they have cornices, everything. You squint your eyes, you could imagine you are in Bolton Hill. It's just not currently occupied sufficiently.
Okay, but it has not been clear to anyone how to get from what we have now to that vision you see when you squint your eyes. In other words, how, and Lucky Crosby, let me ask you too, how do you foresee creating the conditions in which someone would come in and redevelop either around the existing homes, rehabbing them, or if there is a whole block that needs to be pulled down, how do you see pulling in the development interest to do
that? Let me just say, it has to be quite a lot of development interest for the mayor and the governor to knock down entire blocks. And let me say from my point of view, when you have a mayor who bet her political career on being able to attract 10,000 families from outside of Baltimore City, so the new developer plans have to be housing with garages, because let's be honest, a Caucasian family would like to be safe driving their families into a garage. So those houses do not have garages. But if you know anything about architect like the gentleman you have, architectural like the gentleman you have on the show, those houses are big enough where they can sustain a driving garage. But to answer your question, and I go back to this question, when you lived in that community and you doesn't have a decent a decent food market, we would like part of the development to be a supermarket. But when you're going to come in now with $300,000 to $400,000 homes, you displacing a lot of people that on decent and affordable housing list that will be priced out of it. And when the gentleman mentioned Highland Park, case in point, if you drive down the 1300 block of Gilmore's, it's completely empty down there. The only thing you have down there is funeral home. So what I am saying, it was a plan to let those houses sit and be vacant, because years and years and years, plans have been in the working to somehow to gain that property to do a development. And a developer does not want to do scatter sites. They want to be able to do a whole community block. And now you're going to have, in cases there, they coming up from the 1100 all the way up to the 1300 block. Then they going down to Gilmore. So they going to have hundreds of thousand acreage to do the development that they want to do.
You mentioned $400,000 homes. It's my understanding that the governor's plan is to make available subsidies and incentives for developers to build affordable priced homes. Klaus, do you have any insight?
Well, that I wanted to say anyway that the $700 million plan consists of $100 for demolition, and we shouldn't just talk about demolition, but also about the money that is spent for rehabbing, redeveloping, and revitalizing the community. And we have a relatively dim understanding right now what these other $600 million are. My understanding right now is that most of that money is money that was already allocated in grants and federal funding. It's rental assistance demonstration program money, and it is bond money. So it's not necessarily new money. What's new is that focus on these disinvested areas in Baltimore. That money could have gone somewhere else. So this is basically
somewhere else in the state, not necessarily to Baltimore.
And so that is good news that the state is focusing. So I don't want to diminish that. That is very good news that there is this focus. But the core question of how we get people back into our neighborhoods and in a region that grows by hundreds of thousands of people, why can't Baltimore capture a portion of that? And I believe it can, and it will. And we are on the way of doing this. And so have Boston, so have Washington, D.C. They have gradually filled in their neighborhoods again. They had vacant houses to the galore as well some decades ago. So it can be done. And once it's done, then everybody's glad that those houses are still there, like we are glad that we still have Federal Hill and Fells Point and Bolton Hill, Reservoir Hill, that those houses are actually there and that they were kept around even when they were vacant in between.
Let me pull Susan into the conversation. Susan is calling from Baltimore, sort of underscoring a point that Lucky Crosby made. Susan, welcome to Midday.
Well, it's nice to be here, and thank you for taking my call.
Your comment?
I'm sorry?
Your comment?
Yeah, my comment is, first of all, I applaud the decision to put money into the city of Baltimore. But as a lead paint poisoning prevention professional for close to 30 years, my concern is how the process is going to be done in the demolition of these homes. That while, you know, we have, we want to not, you know, make a wrong approach in trying to make a good decision here. You know, lead poisoning prevention has been such a hot topic in the city and in the state for years. And I would hope that in the process of planning that we take into account that most of these homes that are going to be raised do in fact have a lot of lead-based paint, and that we would want to take them down in a way that was lead safe. And I would encourage everybody to take this not lightly and to make sure that we're just not going to take buildings down and create more of a lead hazard.
Susan, I appreciate your call. And I should say that we are planning here at Midday to do a full hour on the governor's plan and how people are reacting to it, where we hope to have someone from the state and be able to take more calls. So we consider this a down payment on this issue, not the last word that Midday will do. But Lucky Crosby, I do want to get back to your concerns about the community not being involved. I have assumed, I'm not sure that I've actually read this or that I have any reason to assume this, but I've assumed that the governor's demolition plan, and I take your point, Klaus, that demolition is in monetary terms, a small part of the overall dollar amount that the governor talked about investing, but he certainly did make it a visual focus by having the bulldozer right there as he spoke. And I just assumed that that this new partnership with the state, this 4-year partnership to clear a lot of city blocks, was something that is based on the city's own process for identifying vacants that
should be torn down as opposed to vacants that should be saved. Is Lucky, since you've been working on these issues for a long time as a community activist, is there such a process, and does that process involve the community?
No, there is no such process, and the community was not involved in this. What you had people like an organization called Chesapeake Habitat in the Governor Ear, who was formerly Sandtown Habitat for Humanity. Now it's taken over by Chesapeake Habitat, and they had a lobbyist down in City Hall supposed to be speaking for the community. I won't say the person's name, but he knows who he is. He also is the executive director or the co-executive director of Chesapeake Habitat. So you had him in the governor's ear, and then again, what I'm saying and what I'm adamantly opposed to, some of those houses could have been saved and families should have been put in them. Now, mind you, when you don't have the community input, you have these plans where the governor came, like John Wayne with his bulldozer, and this is what I'm going to do regardless of what the people want, and then you have maybe the most polarizing figure behind him, with the intentionally kept him off the camera, Paul T. Graziano.
He is the commissioner.
He is the commissioner of the city side. Now, the point being that he may be the third most hated man in Baltimore, and he's standing, and now all of a sudden, he's speaking for the communities of Sandtown. If you're not familiar with Gilmore Holmes Live in Sandtown, Winchester.
Well, you're raising a lot of, I can tell, quite emotional points, and I look forward to talking with you again to understand this better and to understand better what the state is doing and what room there is for working together, which is what the mayor said she hoped to do. Klaus, I need to wrap this up. Is there a last thought you want to give us as we will all be learning more about this? As you said, our understanding right now is somewhat dim.
Well, the West Baltimore communities have made plans to the galore over the years, and there is certainly a lot of planning in the drawers that can be pulled out with the $600 million and be realized. So it's the community has oftentimes spoken, and it's just necessary to listen to them.
Well, we'll try to be part of that listening process. Lucky Crosby, Sr., lifetime Sandtown resident, community organizer, thank you very much for speaking with us
today. Thank you for having me.
And Klaus Philipson of Arc Plan Incorporated, author of the Community Architect blog. Thanks, and I'll see you later in the show.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, John Fritzy of the Baltimore Sun will bring us up to speed on the political contest between Congressmen Chris Van Hollen and Donna Edwards. They're the Democrat frontrunners vying to fill the Senate seat that will be vacated by Barbara Mikulski's retirement. Plus, Representative Elijah Cummings has yet to indicate whether he'll enter that race. So stay tuned. We'll talk about that. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be back in just a bit. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. It's all about women voters, as Representative Chris Van Hollen of Montgomery County and Representative Donna Edwards of Prince George's County square off for the Democratic nomination for U.S. Senate, the seat now being held by Barbara Mikulski, who has announced she's retiring. Joining us by phone is John Fritzy, politics reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Welcome back to the show, John.
Hi, Sheila. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. John, why are women voters key in this race?
For a couple of reasons. First of all, they tend to vote more. So about 6 in 10 primary voters, Democratic primary voters, tend to be women. They also tend to be the most ardent voters as well, the most likely to come out to vote, what the party often calls super voters, folks who show up for election after election. And so both of these candidates, look ahead and think about trying to get people out to the polls, you kind of get more bang for your buck if you go after a women. Doesn't mean they're writing off men. They're still competing for that, but certainly women voters has been a focus of this campaign for the past couple of weeks.
And how does that focus show itself? What is it you're seeing in covering the race?
Well, I think there's two things. I mean, on Donna Edwards' side, her biggest support right now is coming from Emily's List, which is a Washington-based group that supports Democratic women and actually was an early supporter of Barbara Mikulski's in the 86 race for Senate. So on the Edwards side, that is one of the manifestations. Chris Van Hollen put out an ad in direct response to that, sort of talking about his support from women. So both these folks are running advertisements, television advertisements, that speak directly to women on what the candidates feel like are issues they care about, things like paid family leave, equal pay for equal work. These are all issues that Democrats are talking about nationally, and they're getting a big ride in this Senate race.
Speaking of Emily's list, there was a controversy when Emily's list accused Van Hollen's campaign of going after its donors. Catch us up on that, and how did Van Hollen's campaign respond to the accusation?
It's interesting because it's one of the first kerfuffles over the campaign itself, right? We've had some differences on policy between these candidates, but this is the first time that the two campaigns have sort of gone after each other on the technical aspects of the campaign. Essentially, what happened here is that Emily's List sent out an email to its supporters, which is something that these groups do all the time, and it claims that inadvertently described Chris Van Hollen as a Republican. And that's touchy because one of the things that Edwards is trying to do is paint Van Hollen as something other than a progressive. So whether it was inadvertent or not, there's no way to know, but certainly the impact was there because this is part of the Edwards campaign's message. What Van Hollen then did was send out a note to many of the same people that donate to Emily's lists saying, hey, look, they got this wrong, and by the way, give us some campaign cash. The issue that Emily's List is raising is that Van Hollen technically is not supposed to go through to an organization's donors and send out a solicitation. And so the question is, was Van Hollen setting the record straight, or was he soliciting money? I think that's going to be up to the Federal Election Commission to sort of find the fine line in there.
So that's something the FEC will actually have to, like, take testimony and make a ruling, and that presumably will come long after the primary in April.
The way these things work out, I have no doubt that's the case. Look, I think this is sort of an interesting thing for political insiders, folks who are following this very closely. I'm not sure that most voters are going to pay super close attention to this. Both these guys are going to run pretty solid technical campaigns. They're both members of Congress. They've done this before. I don't think we're going to see a lot of stuff like this, but it was interesting on many different levels. Again, one of which being this question of whether was this mistake inadvertent or not, no one can really tell. And then another being exactly how did Van Hollen decide who to send this solicitation to? I'm not sure we're really going to get to the bottom of that either.
The Washington Post this week ran a story. I'm sure you've observed the same phenomenon. Their headline was, "Why Donna Edwards is Struggling for Money in Her Quest for a Senate Seat." They reported, and as I said, I know these would be FEC numbers that everyone knows, Donna Edwards has less than $400,000 in the bank at the end of September and had not run any television ads by that point. Van Hollen at that point had $4.1 million. What is the dynamic of fundraising in this campaign? What do you point to when you look at the disparity in the fundraising that these two candidates have done?
Right. I mean, the first thing is that Donna Edwards has never been a great fundraiser. Even in her races for Congress, she was not a prolific fundraiser. By contrast, Chris Van Hollen has always been an aggressive fundraiser, even when he faced token opposition for the 8th congressional seat. He raised a significant amount of money. He is a former chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which helps elect Democrats to Congress. And so
that is essentially a fundraising function.
Precisely. I mean, the guy has contacts that can help him raise money. Edwards, by contrast, has always billed herself as an outsider, as someone who isn't sort of on the inside of these various rooms with these high-rolling donors. And so, it's not a huge surprise that she has been unable to raise a lot of money. I think the question for Edwards, I mean, I don't think anybody's surprised that Van Hollen has outraised Edwards. The question is, does Edwards have enough to compete? And I think that's a question that remains. I think we'll know more at the end of this month. We'll get a new report. At the end of January, we'll get a new report sort of showing where they stand now. The question is, will Edwards have enough to run advertisements, to run a ground game, to do the kind of things she needs to do? A statewide campaign is different than a congressional campaign, partly because it's way more expensive. And so I think it remains to be seen whether she will have enough money to really compete with his advertising.
And do the endorsements that each of them have lined up tell us anything about that same question, how viable their two candidates will be?
You know, the endorsements are interesting. One of the questions is how much do they really matter, right? So Van Hollen has racked up all of these endorsements from Maryland, groups inside Maryland, state lawmakers from Maryland. It's really fascinating. Edwards, by contrast, has locked up more national groups, groups that, you know, you sort of a question, well, what, you know, what's their Maryland connection? I don't know. They, some of these groups do have a fair number of members, like Emily's List. Others, it's not so clear. And so there is this dichotomy in her picking up these national endorsements and him picking up these local officials. She will say, well, look, this just points to that he's plugged in. He's kind of an insider. And she will sort of almost state that she's proud of not having as many endorsements from these kinds of people. I think that the big endorsement, the one that matters the most right now, was the SEIU. The SEIU is a, of course, there's several local chapters. They represent all kinds of workers, from hospital workers and security guards all over the state. And SEIU has long been with
Service Employees International Union.
Right, right, right. Very politically active, one of the most politically active unions in Maryland. A longtime Edwards supporter, backed Chris Van Hollen late last year. I think that was a real blow to the Edwards campaign. It remains to be seen how much they're going to do for Van Hollen, but certainly symbolically, that was a pretty significant switch of loyalty.
Just briefly, on the Republican side, who's running in the primary?
Right, right. So you've got a bunch of folks. I think the person who's had the best ride in the polls has been Kathy Schlage, who's a state delegate from Baltimore County. She has the best name ID. Many of these sort of quote-unquote establishment Republicans, although that's a little bit of a dirty word in the GOP these days, so I'll use that word. They wouldn't use it. Many of the folks you would know in the Republican Party in Maryland are backing Delegate Schlage. You've got Chris Kefalis, who is a former Ehrlich aide, works for the National Manufacturing Association down here in D.C. He's a kind of a young, new blood guy who's running. You know, there's a number of other candidates, but those are the two that are, I think, doing the most campaigning right now. But, you know, they are not doing a ton of campaigning right now, by contrast, compared to the Democrats. I think they're going to wait and see who the nominee is before their campaigns really kick off.
One other element about this race that I want to raise before I let you go, John Fritzy of the Baltimore Sun, Representative Elijah Cummings, a lot of speculation about whether he would enter the Senate race. He has less than 4 weeks to file nomination papers. The deadline is February 3rd. When he spoke with Maryland Morning host Tom Hall this week, Tom asked if Cummings thought he'd be able to do more on gun control if he was in the Senate.
You know, that's hard to say. Here in the House, I have a large staff because of the role I play as ranking member of oversight. Still trying to figure that one out. But I want to do whatever will allow me to be most effective in representing my constituents and the people of Maryland and certainly the people of the United States.
Are you thinking about running for the Senate seat that Senator Mikulski is going to vacate?
Of course. Of course.
And the filing deadline is the 3rd of February.
I bet
you didn't know that, huh?
Okay, I have it circled, believe me.
John Fritzy, do you think Representative Cummings is seriously considering a run?
I don't. I think, let me say this. I think that Cummings has become a pretty powerful political figure, both in Maryland and in Washington. He's doing all the right things. If he got into the race, he would absolutely be a factor and absolutely be a threat. The polls all show that he could potentially be an instant front runner in the race. I think the thing is that while the legal deadline to file is February 3rd, the practical deadline, the steps that must be taken to mount a statewide campaign, I think it would be a very difficult thing for him to put that together in a few months. And so 100% it's not going to happen? No. I mean, anything could happen, and he could certainly jump in. But he's not taking any steps right now that indicate that he's going to run. He's not really raising money. He's letting people that would endorse him endorse other candidates. You know, there's no real indication that he is he's taking this seriously. So I tend not to like to do predictions in politics, but I feel like there's a pretty good chance that he is going to not do it. But we'll see.
Yeah, one can certainly see why any politician doesn't mind having people speculate about whether he would be welcome in a race and how strong he would be. So I can imagine there's no particular reason to snuff out the speculation.
There's no reason at all. There's no reason at all. But then there becomes a question of what does his indecision mean for the race? Is it hurting Donna Edwards, let's say, perhaps more than Chris Van Hollen, because African-American leaders in Baltimore who might want to endorse an African-American candidate are going to sit back and wait to see what Cummings does. Or maybe there's other ways that helps Van Hollen. I think, for me, the interesting question right now is what does his not announcing what he's going to do at this point, how does that impact the race that we have on the ground now?
Well, and of course, that will be over in less than 4 weeks. John Fritzi, I really appreciate your walking us through all this. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
John Fritzi covers politics for the Baltimore Sun. We're going to take our last break here. When we return, Klaus Philipson will also return, along with Baltimore Business Journal's Melody Simmons, to walk us through Under Armour CEO Kevin Plank's huge development plans for Port Covington, plus new tech and fitness products from Under Armour. So stay with us for that. Yes, we are continuing. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. We talked earlier this hour about a potentially transformative plan, one to address blight in Baltimore. Another potentially transformative plan was unveiled this week. Under Armour CEO Kevin Plank has a grand vision for South Baltimore's Port Covington, a vision that includes restaurants, residential and retail space, entertainment venues, parks, and a campus for 5,000 Under Armour employees. Klaus Philipson is joining me again. He's president of the architecture firm Arc Plan Incorporated. Welcome back. And Melody Simmons, whom you used to hear on air sometimes when she was a producer for Midday. Now she's real estate reporter for the Baltimore Business Journal. Welcome back. Welcome back to Midday.
Thank you. It's so nice to be back. Thank you.
Melody, describe what the master plan for this Port Covington project looks like.
Well, this is a whopper. We were called over to the Sagamore Development offices in Locust Point earlier this week for a press briefing, and it became very apparent very fast that they are building what I would consider to be a new Riviera, a new mini city down in Port Covington, which right now is kind of forgotten. It's old industrial land, but Sagamore has plans to develop 266 acres down there with 13 million square feet of office, residential, retail, restaurants, entertainment venues, and let's not forget, 50 acres is going to be developed as well for the Under Armour new global headquarters, also on the site. So it's massive.
It does seem massive. And I guess, Klaus, one of my first thoughts in hearing about it, especially in the context of the story we talked about earlier, whether there will be developer interest in developing blocks in that the city may clear of vacants in other parts of this city. Is there that much developer interest in Baltimore? I mean, some of what they're talking about at Port Covington, it's retail with residential units atop.
Yes.
And there was all, I don't assume that most of them will be affordable, but there was talk at the planning board about making sure that this is a mixed income development.
Well, I did ask that question at the press briefing, will you have affordable housing? And it was very sketchy on the answer. I don't think that they're down the road that far yet with plans about what kind of units they're going to put in. So it's kind of mushy at this point. However, they are going to come in and ask for tax breaks, tax increment financing. There's no infrastructure on the site. So that may lead to a mandate that they have inclusionary housing.
Okay. So again, it could be that I'm just sort of letting the developments of the week overtake my thinking on this, and it's really two completely different kinds of development and that they aren't
in
competition.
It is connected. That is the point. It's really exciting times in Baltimore. And I believe, and I have said that for 20 years, that Baltimore is positioned in a growing region and next to Washington, D.C., to do and become yet again the powerhouse that we once were. And we suffer from ripping our hair out constantly over whether we can do this and that in Baltimore. And we can. And here comes Kevin Plank and says, you know, I do big stuff. And I can do it. And, you know, of course, he has proven already that he can do big things. And so coming in with this Planktown is
Planktown.
is really very exciting. And the plans, the way they were presented, are relatively progressive. So they are doing the right things. They're making walkable streets. They're mixed use. They are doing sort of a traditional city in a way. And they are creating 40 acres of public parks. They're creating promenades. They are creating greenways. So there will be a light rail connection if everything goes to plan. Of course, you know, this is the first time we have seen this. And so therefore, we don't know whether how much of that will be delivered. But it is interesting to me to see the high ambition and the high quality of these plans with these folks of out of Boston that they have as the master planners. They are not aiming for small potatoes. They are not aiming for average things. They are aiming for highest expectations and highest standards. And that is what Baltimore was so sorely missing over so many years, that we always say, well, we don't deserve this. We can't do this. We don't. We settle for something lesser. And that attitude creates demand. That attitude creates a higher quality. So it's a self running course in a way that you can see also with Seawall's developments or some other developers that have come in and have said, we can build in Baltimore apartments that have the quality of apartments of New York or other big cities. And they were successful. They filled them right away. And that creates additional demand. It's not a zero-sum game.
It's going to take years.
Many years, up to two decades.
And I'm trying to picture, I don't understand the development process that well. I'm trying to understand, given how little is there now, and maybe you should just take a minute, Melody, and tell us what's there now. There's a Walmart.
There's an existing Walmart. It's still open. There is a former Sam's Club, which has been converted to Under Armour offices, and employees are going to start moving in there right away. You can see that. I drove through the complex yesterday. There's Nick's Fish House, which Under Armour has bought, still operating as a fish house and a bar. And actually, Under Armour has put two new bars in there over the past year since they bought it, outdoor bars. And there's still Lock Industries, which is a large industrial complex that they have not bought. They have not, they haven't had a chance to buy, or they haven't had any luck acquiring. But right now, the waterfront is littered. It's a real mess. They have their work cut out for them. They're going to be bringing, kind of releasing and rolling out more detailed plans for this over this year to the city planning process, the UDARP. And we expect to see the first phase of that in the next maybe month and a half.
So, Klaus, I'm trying to understand how you can do, I don't want to say piecemeal, because that implies there's not a plan. And clearly, from what you say about high quality and from the way Melody's describing this, there will be a plan, but it will be a slow-moving plan. How do you get the first phase or the first and second phases attracting tenants and getting people excited when you still have so much that is undeveloped right there on that same area?
Well, unlike some of the other things that we have been talking about, EBDI area or the Sandtown area, so here we don't have to necessarily just have a plan and then wait for the market. Here we have the big powerhouse, the engine that makes it happen is the corporate global headquarters, as they call it, for their own company, and they are going to build that. And
so Under Armour is what makes this
Under
work.
Under Armour makes that first phase work, and then they will, they say, in order, and they understand that as a successful employer and global corporation, they can only compete with Nike, you know, Nike Town, and that's sort of on their mind. If they are attracting the highest quality people that they can get. And how can they get them? By offering them an urban environment that is attractive. That's how corporations these days compete, is by location and urban environment and attractive setting for the quality of life. And they understand that, and that's why they are doing the quality. And then the citizens of Baltimore, they get access to these things via public walkways, parks, and waterfronts. And so it could be really a win-win for everybody that way.
Well, Another, you mentioned location. Another thing I need you to explain to me. They have high hopes. I've forgotten. I think it's more than 50%. They expect 50% of trips to the redeveloped Port Covington to mm-hmm. be by either walking, bike,
water taxi,
or some kind of mass mm-hmm. transit, not
light
cars,
rail.
In other
well,
words.
Well, that's the
but
most interesting part of
that. I think of Port Covington as sort of so cut off. I mean, you've got 95 running along, and I think of it as, it surprised me it is hard for me to think of it as connected so closely
so
to the rest of the city.
The listeners may not all know even where it is, because it is sort of cut off and most people haven't set foot into Port Covington. So when you are on 95 and approaching the tunnel to work towards New York, then on the right side, that is Port Covington, where you see sometimes a cruise ship. You see the Sun Paper building standing there, which is part of the property that they acquired. And on the left side is Federal Hill. And so it is separated by elevated 95. And what they are proposing, and then north-south, you have the Hanover Street Bridge, which is also anyway designed for reconstruction, redecking. And so there are considerable access problems. And so what they are proposing is to have a spur from the light rail line from Westport or from the stadium station come over into their area. And the water taxi is just an extension of the current water taxi system. Then they want to lower the approach of the Hanover Street Bridge, which is elevated, and they want to fill the areas under the 95 viaducts with sports fields and activity centers to create this connectivity so that this is a natural extension of Federal Hill.
So we have to wrap this up. So Melody, tell us, you mentioned that they're going to be unveiling, the Sagamore will be unveiling more pieces of this, but is it going to, will it go for approval and to the planners as an entire project, or will it go phase by phase?
It's going to go piecemeal. And the next shoe to drop, I believe, should be some kind of master plan or vision of what that global headquarters for Under Armour looks like. When they presented the maps to us, it was just kind of gray area. You know, here it is, it's gray. Everything else they kind of detailed in Port Covington. So we're waiting to see what that 3 million square foot campus is going to look like. And I think that's the next thing to come before the city.
Melody, you have also written about the revamp of the Lexington Market. We've sort of run out of time today, so I'm going to ask you back to tell us about that sometime. What is today's cover story?
Today's cover story is a preview of the General Assembly by Rick Seltzer, and it's pretty comprehensive about some of the top issues that the legislators will be facing in Annapolis this year.
Oh, terrific. I'm going to read that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melody Simmons of the Baltimore Business Journal, and Klaus Philipson, president of the architecture firm ArcPlan Incorporated.
Good to be here.
I appreciate the conversation. I want to turn now to Julie Bort. She's tech editor for Business Insider. She wrote about some technology unveiled by Under Armour earlier this week, a fitness app called Record, as well as a fitness tracker. Tell us about these products, Julie.
Hi. Yeah, it's good to be here. Hey, so Under Armour came out of nowhere a couple of years ago, and it has just been going gangbusters in the fit tech market. So one of the cool things that it unveiled this week is this app called Record. And this app called Record could be like an amazing personalized coach in your pocket. It's using technology from IBM, that super smart computer called Watson.
Uh-huh.
So then it's taking all the data that you enter into all these Under Armour apps, and, you know, if you have a fitness band, all that kind of stuff. It's mapping it with its resources. It's got a giant nutritional database. It's got millions of athletes that input their own data. And it's coming up with, personalized suggestions for what you should be doing that day, if it works as advertised. That's what they're trying to do anyway. So these would be things like literally telling you, hey, you didn't eat enough carbs today to make your performance for the run you have scheduled tomorrow. So it could be, you know, fairly amazing step forward in what these sort of fitness tracking apps can do for us.
I must say, Julie Bort, when I heard the name of the app, Record, didn't give me any clue that it was going to be that proactive in telling me. It just sounded to me like it was going to keep track of things like a lot of other trackers keep track of things.
I don't know about the name of it, Record. And certainly there's a gazillion of these apps that are recording all of your data. And, you know, and they're built, now they're baked in, right? So Apple's got its own health kit, and, you know, they're baked into the phone. But the cool thing about this is that they've gone one step farther, and they're working with IBM's Watson computer. Are you familiar with that?
Familiar would overstate it. I am aware of Watson.
So Watson is this super smart analytics computer, and it understands language, and it understands all kinds of data, and it can, and then it can personalize data. So it's working with that to take all of this fitness data that we've now gathered in the world. You know, you've got your personal data on your phone, and then they've got all this data in like MapMyFitness and in MyFitnessPal and that kind of thing. And it's trying to come up with actual, very personal recommendations for you. So maybe Record isn't the name that makes it sound like it's doing all that. But this could be, if it really does work as advertised, that's a big if, it could be huge for people. They could really get the next phase of help from these apps.
And then there's this other new thing called Health Box.
Yeah, so as part of this whole thing that Under Armour wants to do with FitTech, you know, they say they want to take FitTech to the next level. They announced sort of the first real hardware segments. So it's a fitness band, and this fitness band is sort of a revised fitness band that HTC had put out and kind of killed. So, but it came back to life, reincarnated, with this Under Armour kit of stuff. So a fitness band, a heart strap monitor, and then one of those fancy scales that tells you everything about your body. You know.
Oh, I see.
Body,
so
fat percentage,
it all kind of all kind of relates. And what is the price point for these things?
So the bundle is $400, and you know that's not the low end. It's not a bargain. Like if you were to buy sort of these, like, you know, it's like a modest fitness band. It doesn't do everything under the sun. The high end ones cost about $200. The modest ones cost a lot less than that. And you know, the weight scales cost about, I don't know, you can get one for $175. They're like those are kind of pricey, but the straps are really inexpensive, like $60. So if you were to sort of put that all together, it would probably cost you $100 less, I would say. But quality is an issue, so I haven't had a chance to actually test these. If they're higher quality, it's about in there, but it's sort of on the pricier end.
Julie, this is really interesting. I really appreciate your giving us a sample of this stuff.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Great. Happy to help.
Julie Bort, tech editor at Business Insider. I want to thank all of our guests on the show today, and I also want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, local craft beers. Locations and hours you can find at joesquared.com. Midday will be back on Monday with a look inside the University of Maryland Shock Trauma Center. Until then, have a safe and relaxing weekend. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Connor Graham. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.